morning. Welcome.
Good morning.
Dr. Sulik. Members, we don't have a quorum yet, but we want to get started at a reasonable time here. Dr. Sulik, if you could please introduce yourself for the tape and give us your presentation, we'd appreciate that.
Thank you. Madam Chair, I'm Dr. Reed Sulik, Assistant Commissioner for the Chemical and Mental Health Services Administration for the Minnesota Department of Human Services. Sitting to my right is Mr. Michael Tesner, who is the Chief Executive Officer for state-operated services under the Chemical and Mental Health Services Administration. I've been asked to present an overview of the state-operated services redesign report and the plan that has been released in the last 2 weeks by the Department of Human Services. I'll just quickly make a statement to the committee that I'm under some pressures to try to get on an airplane at 1 o'clock today, so I am going to be having to leave probably about 10 to 12. If there are continued questions, Mr. Tesner can continue.
I'm hoping we're going to be done.
Great.
Plenty of time.
Okay. what I'd like to start with is a little bit of background. As you all know, the department released our report regarding the state operated services redesign. The purpose of that report was to address a number of different things. First was to speak to a broader based vision of what we are proposing to do differently with state operated services. Also to try to describe to everyone how we anticipate solving a $17 million budget deficit that is currently within the state operated services system for the remainder of this biennium. We also wanted to lay down the framework for the call for us to identify a plan to redesign the Anoka Regional Treatment Center and the MEDO, which is the Minnesota Extended Treatment Options, that went into, that was a call in legislation at the last session last year. To start with, I'd like to just quickly review with you why we propose to redesign state-operated services. I will intend to speak specifically to what we are proposing to change and redesign as far as the entire system. And then I'll try to address the how and the when. The report clearly did not go into the how and the when. The report was released at a very high level without a tremendous amount of details. We recognize that that lack of details has created a considerable amount of questions, if not a considerable amount of angst as well, because of the lack of details in there. I hope to address some of that today, but I also will be pointing out that we have a process planned between now and June 30th to really engage actively work groups to help us flesh out some of the design components of this plan. As just some background information, I'd like to just bring reference to the portion of state-operated services funding that makes up the total expenditures in adult mental health care. Of the public adult mental health dollars in the state of Minnesota, here's just taking a snapshot view at the calendar year of 2008. The reason the calendar year 2008 was chosen here as opposed to the fiscal year to demonstrate this is it was the calendar year 2008 that represented the investments from the Adult Mental Health Initiative. So that total investments into public adult mental health dollars in the state of Minnesota is $595,529,000 for calendar year 2008. The state operated services appropriation during that period of time was $181 million. Now, that $181 million does not make up the enterprise component of state operated services. It's specifically what is appropriated by the legislature to the department to operate the segments of state operated services that fall under the appropriation. As you know, that's
Can you explain that distinction again?
Yeah. Okay, so several of our programs are appropriated by the state, so fully funded by the state, and we need to operate within the budget of that funding, and that's what is the appropriation. There's also the enterprise component of state-operated services, which is operating without any appropriation. The care programs,
right.
For example,
okay.
The MSOCS programs, the dental clinics, which I'm going to have to address in this report as well.
Okay, thank you.
So state-operated services funding, that appropriation alone represents about 30% of the total adult public mental health dollars. So one of the reasons to bring reference and focus on state-operated services, it is still a very large component of the total funding. And our belief is that anything that we can do to improve the efficiency and the effectiveness of the system and improve its integration with the rest of the community and mental health systems across the state will ultimately improve the entire mental health system. I want to bring reference to that this report and this plan is specific to the high-end cost components of state-operated services. We really needed to focus on where is the most expensive areas of care in our state system, and how do we try to streamline and redesign and improve what we do so that we can ultimately reduce the degree of expenditures. So hopefully this percentage of the total is different. We currently spend $262 million on a combination of our regional treatment center costs and total community inpatient costs in the state. So of that $595 million of total expenditures, there is roughly 44% in calendar year 2008 was spent on inpatient care at some level. So that includes Anoka Regional Treatment Center. That includes the Minnesota Security Hospital under the state-operated forensic services, because those are under the appropriation. But it also includes our community behavioral health hospitals, and it includes our community inpatient hospital programs across the state. So if we lump all those together and just say, how much are we really spending on inpatient care in this state, it is, in calendar year 2008, it was 44%. This is just a demonstration of looking, based on inflation-adjusted dollars, over the last 8 or 9 years, what percentage are we still spending on inpatient care? You can see that the movement in the state was to move out of the large institutions across the state. We've all been part of that process over the last many years. That has not dramatically changed the total expenditure on inpatient care, though. And so as we look at this data, it shows that there's starting to be a trend down in the total cost of that combination of regional treatment center and community inpatient care. And that's starting in fiscal year 2004, but it's a very subtle trend down. The investments that have been made in the community level of care across the system, and honestly, the adult mental health initiative that was passed in 2007, that's a significant investment in community-based levels of care. And that led to a decrease, honestly, in the utilization of the community behavioral health hospitals that we have in plan. We have 10 community behavioral health hospitals that started coming into place around the same period of time. There was an estimate, essentially 160 beds were put into the system as a result of the closing of the regional treatment centers. The intention was that, and based on the estimates, that those individuals, that there was a need for approximately up to 160 beds. The utilization over the last many years has been roughly about half of that. Why has it been half of that? There's a couple reasons. One is the community investments have been significant. We're starting to see trends that validate to us that has worked at decreasing the reliance on the community inpatient level of care. However, the length of stay in the community behavioral health hospitals was significantly less. The average length of stay at the community behavioral health hospitals is about 20 days. The average length of stay at the Anoka Regional Treatment Center is 100 plus days. So we're still talking about in changing the way that level of care is provided, and creating a different model than the regional treatment center. It led to a shorter length of stay. So,
and Representative Root, yes, had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And maybe you're kind of getting to my question, I think. And my question is it because we have people in inpatient longer because we don't have anywhere in the community to place them?
Mr. Chair and Representative, that's a great question, and we believe that that's been a significant piece of this. The significant piece of the long length of stay at Anoka is we still need a much more integrated array of services in the metro region to be able to flow individuals out of Anoka so that length of stay could be significantly less and they could be served much more appropriately in the community. And we've been here to the committee before and presented some of our own data from the patients in the system currently over the last year. And if you recall, I presented LOCUS data that indicated it appears that not everybody's needing to be in the hospital at the hospital level of care. About 25% of the people on any given day met criteria at LOCUS level 6 for the inpatient level of care. About 50% of the people met a LOCUS level 5. Now, what we presented was there was difficulty in moving individuals out of the inpatient program into community programs, whether it's a community residential treatment program, such as our intensive regional treatment centers, or other community-based programming. So that was one of the factors. Now, if we had a much better integrated system, could that length of stay be shorter? And could this graph be essentially much different in the future? The goal is really what is the percentage that we should aim for in the state of Minnesota when it comes to looking at our total inpatient cost in comparison to our total cost of care, total investment in care in the state? We want to see a much smaller proportion of inpatient cost compared to the total cost.
And have you done any discussion, and maybe we'll get to this, about some of the decisions we're making this year in terms of investment in community mental health and what that'll do to this trend and how that applies to the redesign?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, as we all know, that there's been some loss in the investments that have been made. And as a matter of fact, we've had to take some money out of the total system. The GMAC bill that just was passed will take some adult mental health grant dollars out. I mean, I believe it's like $7.8 million. I have the numbers here. But as we look at that, you know, that is directly hitting exactly what we've invested in a couple of years ago. And it is important. One of the things that we had to think about as I talk about sort of the raw, hard information about our own budget deficit and state operated services is how can we solve this while still maintaining a degree of capacity should the utilization requirements increase for state operated services levels of care as our community system is impacted by what's happening across the system. I'll tell you what I have really tried to get my administration to do in regards to this is to really aggressively examine state-operated services, because I did not want to take $17 million of funding out of the adult mental health system elsewhere. So we've had to literally talk about how do we save $17 million within this current system, because we recognize the adult mental health grants to the counties and other sources of aids are going to be impacted and have been impacted. One of the things that you've heard me talk about before as we think about a redesign of the state system is how do we maximize all opportunities for funding and reimbursement of the services we provide so that we can literally maximize all areas of funding, including federal funding that we may not be seeking yet in all the right ways. So the fact that we've had services provided in a way that does not allow us to be eligible to bill for MA dollars has led to us needing to rethink our structure and some of our services so that we can get to a place where literally every service is ultimately a billable service and is maximizing all opportunities for funding. We had some significant confluence of pressures on state-operated services in the past year. In the last year, we heard significantly lots of gaps and barriers that individuals were experiencing in getting access to care. We heard lots of information about how effective the system was at transitioning an individual through the system and transitioning an individual appropriately back into the community. Our state-operated services system has not been as integrated with the community level of care and aligned with several of the advancements in the community level of care historically. And our intention was we really needed to address that, examine that, and address that, and how to improve the overall system so that we can become much more effective at getting access to the services that are there and that need to be there. We also had some pretty significant inefficiencies in the system. We were continuing to staff units that for 16 beds when we might have had a census of 4. We've had to come up with some creative ways to manage that. Not all of those creative ways have been popular, but we've had to think about the fact that is an additional pressure that we've had to think about.
And Representative Root, I think, had another question.
Yeah.
Thank you. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair.
No, not at all.
Sorry. And it's your previous slide. You just mentioned something about federal funding, and I was wondering, are there federal dollars out there that you see that we could be accessing that we're not?
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes. Many of the services that we provide are certainly services that are completely eligible for MA funding and MA reimbursement. Yet if they're being provided, say, at an Anoka Regional Treatment Center, which is an institute of mental disease that does not allow us to bill MA dollars, then all of the burden of funding comes under that top line, which is the state proportion of the funding. So what we've really had to think about and aggressively examine is how can we provide the appropriate services, but provide them in a way that meets all the requirements for eligibility for private health plan funding, for MA funding, and other sources of funding.
And what's the definition of an institute of mental disease? I mean, can we use ANOCA in a way that would not fit within that definition?
Mr. Chair, yes, there are some.
And you're probably getting there, but
we'll get to some of that. But the definition of institute of mental disease is a facility that has over 16 beds of mental health care, or a larger facility where over 50% of the beds are dedicated to mental health care. So, for instance, if Hennepin County Medical Center, which has today, let's say they have a census of 300 patients, if they had 200 patients on psychiatric beds, they would be an institute of mental disease today. You know, so our community hospitals have had to balance their capacity to provide inpatient care because of that risk of falling into that category. We had another confluence of pressures that I just want to mention is our budget pressure. And I'm going to walk through the details of when you hear us say there's a $17 million budget pressure. I hope to provide a lot of clarity to what makes that up. I also want to just say that there was also a mandate during this period of time to redesign ANOCA and MEDO. Now, I recognize that in the last 2 weeks, there's been a lot of questions about why didn't we come up with a report that just focused on ANOCA and MEDO. And the reason that we did not do that was because the ANOCA and MEDO redesign really could not be done without taking into account everything that's on this slide. There's an additional pressure here, and it was really what was going to happen as a result of GAMEC. So the other arrow adding to the confluence of pressures is us needing to constantly be aware of a trend of a potential increase in commitments and other referrals to the state system that would need us to maintain some appropriate level of capacity. We still are the safety net system in the state, so we had to continuously balance that. This slide, which is slide 8 in your handout, is just essentially trying to address for us what makes up the $17 million budget deficit. I'll start at about the 12 o'clock mark on the pie chart. That $700,000 figure is a result of, in this biennium, as part of the ANOCA restructuring and redesign legislation that was passed last year in session, the $700,000 of savings was to be expected to be accomplished in this biennium, and then a much larger amount of savings was to be accomplished in the next biennium. Immediately to the right is there was a total administrative reduction to state-operated services of $700,000 a year, totaling $1.4 million for the biennium that went into legislation last year. There was an additional operating budget reduction for state-operated services of $1.546 million, and then we had over a $5 million unallotment total. $400,000 from the last fiscal year, the remainder in this fiscal year to accomplish. Those are actual reductions to the state state appropriation for state-operated services.
And what went into that unallotment?
I'm sorry?
What was the unallotment?
The unallotment was a figure of $5 million.
It was just money taken out of the
two state-operated services that we had to... Rather than saying this is how we're going to solve it, we entered that into this total redesign so that we could do two things. And this is where there's a lot of confusion, if not fury, about this, is we are presenting a report and a plan here that says this is how we're solving a $17 million budget deficit. Yet there's also a visioning and redesign process occurring, and the reason that we tried to accomplish both of those together is to make certain that we were not going totally against being aligned with a visioning process that was occurring. So,
and I'm just going to bring the meeting to order here. So.
Great.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, continuing on with the lower right-hand corner, there was in this last fiscal year, there were salary adjustments that were approved in contracting that were unfunded. And because of the budget deficit as it was, there was not room to fund the salary adjustments, and there was expectation that the various business entities would be solving for how to manage those salary adjustments appropriately within the current budget. So that actually was totaling from fiscal year 2009, $2.6 million, And then an additional adjustment for fiscal year 2010, and I apologize for some of the typos on the slide, of $1.35 million. Now, there's an additional item, and this is another area of pretty significant controversy, and this is regarding dental services. I've been before this committee before talking about the pressures on our dental services. We provide 5 dental clinics serving primarily individuals with developmental disabilities who have not been able to be adequately cared for in community dental clinics. That is under the enterprise system. It is not an appropriated service. The state has continuously tried to manage at a loss how to continue to provide that service. We are operating at a $2.2 million loss in the biennium from the dental clinics, and then in addition, with the loss of critical access dental, that added another $420,000 of loss that would have been going to the services providing in the clinic.
And what does that mean exactly, that you have a loss?
So, Mr. Chair, what that means is that the dental clinics have to operate as of today as any other community dental clinic and be able to operate within their budget that is solely from their collections.
So it's an enterprise.
It's an enterprise.
Okay.
So what that means is that they are collecting about half, honestly, of what their total cost is. And they're just, this has been a very costly service to continue to provide.
And the reimbursement is, was it 100% MA essentially? Is it, what's, is that rough?
Well, I bet there's some uncovered individuals serve
oh,
those clinics.
Well.
But it's
there's
but
no private insurance.
There's no private insurance paying for this care in these clinics. Exactly.
Okay. Representative Abler.
Well, I realize we're trying to move through this, but in terms of the that part of it, and that part of the proposal was to close those, right? Is that just a track?
Yeah.
And so I have a question about the on the patient end of it. I just got a couple letters from some random dentists who actually care about this service because they think they can't look after them themselves. What do you think will be? They talked about a 1 or 2 year waiting list. Is that likely to happen if that should occur? And the care of the patients who need it, do you want to, I have a second question, but just respond a little bit.
Mr. Chair, Representative, what I'd say is we honestly don't know today exactly how these individuals can be cared for without the system in place. So what we are proposing here is based on our budget pressures,
right.
We will propose closing 3 of the 5 clinics and then working with our community partners to come up with some model to continue to provide some level of care in some way for these individuals. I've had ideas presented to me in the last 2 weeks, some very creative and thoughtful ideas. We've been working with the School of Dentistry at the University of Minnesota Health Sciences Centers, trying to think about, is there some ways to collaborate so that we can continue to provide these services? Maintaining the 2 clinics that we do have, one in Faribault and one in Brainerd, but we will have to close 3 of the other clinics in order to solve this budget pressure.
And just to follow up,
Representative Abler.
I hear ads on the radio for sedation dentistry, and why couldn't some dentist who was willing to work for those prices, and there's some, you know, Apple Tree and some of those places, why couldn't they just sedate these patients and do what they have to do and live on the MA rates? Is that not an option that could be done in some clinics somewhere? If they wanted that kind of work?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Abel, I'm going to ask Mr. Tesner to address that.
Just short.
It's been a long-standing issue with this population that's served there.
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, we have been down that path before in trying to solicit interest by other dental practice groups. The rate structure has always been in the way. We're in that process again now with the closure of these 3 dental clinics to start making referrals and talking to the potential of other providers taking them up. But historically it has been the rate structure that's gotten in the way.
Yeah. And are we covering sedation now in our public program?
I don't know the answer to that.
Only an outpatient surgical center. Okay, there's the answer.
Okay.
So go ahead. Thank you.
Thanks.
Mr. Chair, just the last item on this page is, as you all know, in the governor's supplemental budget proposal that I presented earlier several weeks ago, there was a $2.2 million additional assignment of a target to state operated services over and above everything on this page, trying to manage the additional budget deficit that we had at this time. So altogether, but you know, just to bring reference, if that $2.2 million in the supplemental budget is included, there's over a $10 million reduction in the state operated services appropriation. The remainder are unfunded expenses that we're trying to manage.
Representative Raven.
Well, and how does that mesh with all the overtime we saw last time you were here? Is that, that seemed puzzling to me, and can you comment about, that doesn't seem like a cost-effective way to do business when you have a pool of people that would like to work straight time.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, the overtime is an enormous cost in the entire system, and it's something that in the last year we've really been examining how to get overtime and on-call expenses reduced dramatically in the system. There has been a trend down in overtime. You see that there was a surge in the data that I presented from St. Peter campus, because the St. Peter workforce got into what appears to be a really significant, very vicious cycle. The amount of the acuity of the patients was had risen. The amount of staff injuries had risen. When staff injuries were, two things happened as people were out sick, and then the way to manage some of the escalations in the patients was to place them on one-to-ones, which required additional staff over and above a pool that they had available. So the amount of overtime increased dramatically. Even the amount of forced overtime increased dramatically. It increases expenses, but it also increases the stress on the workforce, which, again, then contributes to risk of additional injury. And I think that we've got a handle on how to manage that differently than it's been managed so far. But it's across the, it's not just St. Peter that's had overtime. And a lot of that has to do with how the various programs have had to fill positions when they are open, if somebody calls in sick, because they're staffed at a certain level, as opposed to being staffed specific to the census. Now, at Anoka Regional Treatment Center at St. Peter, we're not dealing with fluctuating censuses, typically. I mean, there's always a waiting list to get into St. Peter and Anoka. And so we're not dealing with the fluctuation. So the overtime at those facilities is related to illnesses or injuries or a one-to-one burden that's been put on over and above. And what we are going to try to do differently at the St. Peter campus is, while so many other things are being put into place to reduce the risk of injury for staff, we are adding a float pool of three additional staff members over and above the total need in that 2 p.m. to 10 p.m. shift, which is where the surge of all the injuries seem to be happening most frequently. Not always, but most frequently. And that was a practice that was there several years ago that went away for a variety of different reasons. We certainly want to bring that back on board today during this crisis period to manage the current crisis and try to see if we can't get the entire system calmed down into moving forward. Mr. Chair?
Proceed. Thank you.
So just to say...
So and thank you for meeting, too, with folks and talking about that. I feel like we started to make that was good progress. So,
thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to say that I thought that the group that was here from AskMe are here, obviously, to problem solve. And I did not hear that they were here just to complain. They really want to work with the system, and we really greatly appreciate that. I just want to quickly say, give a little bit, another piece of background, that with that budget pressure, to say this is, and again, this is, I recognize it's still causing some confusion about why are we blending these, but it really felt appropriate that with such significant change in the total appropriation that would be available to us, we needed to really step back, and rather than just cut across the system, focus on where can we achieve some efficiencies, what can we do differently, can we be different, can we get to a completely different place that ultimately will be less costly. I will say that not everybody believes that this is possible, but we do stand behind that we believe after this entire process that we can spend less money and improve the care. But it's going to take a totally different way of doing things than the state operated services has done particularly. And what it's going to take more than anything is a type of partnership with community partners like never before. And I'll talk about that. We did go through a stakeholder input process. We've attempted to get as much input as we can. Not everybody feels like they were able to have the type of input that they really want. The input process is not over. This was a stakeholder input process about what should state operated services be doing in your area, what shouldn't it be doing, What we heard a lot across the state was not specific to just state-operated services, but to the entire mental health system, things that could be much more beneficial to consumers across the state, things that could help consumers stay in their homes and in their communities and prevent hospitalization. And even though we heard lots of that information, and that information is summarized all over the report and the back part of the appendix of the report, that information is not lost. The purpose of this report is to focus on the highest end, most costly level of care and try to see what can we do to change how we are providing that service to get to a different place. That's not saying that we're not moving forward to continue examining a lot of the issues around housing, and peer support services and other things that continuously came up across the state. And I'll highlight some of the things. We had about 1,000 individuals across the whole state participate in these stakeholder meetings, made up of multiple areas of multiple groups of stakeholders represented. Some of the meetings were obviously much more effective than others in regards to how people were able to get input in the process. We did hear, in addition to those meetings, got lots of emails and responses back from people who participated offering some additional information that they weren't able to bring into the meetings. Common threads, this is just a quick snapshot summary of things that were heard in all the different stakeholder meetings at some level of frequency. We tried to tabulate the frequency in which things came forward. We had another stakeholder group come together prior to the release of the report and hear those tabulations of all the different things and try to prioritize areas to focus on. But things that we heard more than anything, probably the most frequently requested change that we heard was improve timely access to state-operated services when needed. We heard that state-operated services...
What does that mean?
Mr. Chair, what that means is when an individual... All it takes is one person to not be able to get admitted to the hospital when they need to get admitted to the hospital to sort of wreak havoc on the whole system. So when somebody... What we heard across the state is the model that had been in place for the last several years of a centralized admission process. That office has been called centralized pre-admissions. So it automatically says that the focus is on saying whether this person should be admitted or not admitted. And what we really heard is what our community partners needed us to be able to provide was a resource helping to improve access to services and care. So if somebody didn't need to be admitted to the hospital, they really needed us, that office, to stay connected and involved to make certain that the individual got the right level of care. And that wasn't happening consistently. I can't say that happened all the time. There were plenty of very appropriate and well-received admissions into the system through central pre-admissions. But we heard consistently that wasn't working the way our community partners needed it to work.
Okay.
We also heard that individuals wanted different levels of care, not just inpatient care. They didn't want to rely on just inpatient care. Not everybody needed to be in the hospital for long durations of time. Is there a way to create other levels of care, other types of services in the communities, tied into the communities that would be more appropriate? We heard loud and clear that the state should not get out of the role of providing the safety net. But as each of you probably can identify, the definition of safety net is quite loose and honestly pretty ill-defined. We've tried to provide some clarity to that in that the role of the state after all these meetings, really the impression seems to be that it continues to be the role of the state to provide the capacity for care for those individuals with the most severe illnesses, but also to provide and influence the capacity of care across the whole system. But it comes down to we continuously are called in to provide assistance and to provide care as needed for individuals with the highest degree of complexities or highest degree of acuities that the community level of care cannot manage well given their current resources. We heard that there would be some providers that would be able to increase their capacity with additional resources. And so what came out of this was, are there ways that the state can partner in a way that enhances the community systems, that shares our appropriation, shares our direct care staff, and shares the clinical expertise that our direct care staff have developed over the years, but is able to do so in a way that allows the business aspect of the operation to be managed as well by a community partner so that they can be billing and collecting in areas that we may not be able to under current structures. So And there's not details of that in the report, because that really, those details still need to get worked out at a level of detail with our, with all the array of partners sitting at the table saying, how could we develop partnerships and develop contracts that could get there? We heard loud and clear that our jails still need lots of outreach and additional services that they're not able to get consistently. Some areas are doing this well. Some areas just don't have the resources to do it well. We heard that there still needs to be services for individuals with this complex co-occurrence of disorders, such as geriatric, our geriatric patients with complex medical complications and psychiatric illnesses, our individuals with psychiatric illnesses and very complex behavioral needs, such as aggression. We heard that pretty much consistently all over. However, we didn't hear that those are enormous numbers, so that not every community needed the capacity to have a place to manage individuals with these needs, but they needed to have access to a place that can manage individuals with these needs and integrate it.
And Representative Loeffler had a question.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Reed. One of the things I don't see here as you're discussing this, and I'm wondering whether it came out in your planning analysis or in your discussions with the various stakeholders, is something that I keep hearing about, which is looking at the geographic and demographic changes, both in terms of accessibility. You know, over 70, almost 70% of the children under 18 are in the 7-county metro area, so the future is really going to be much more concentrated metro than it has been even in the past. Right. And we have much more diversity to deal with currently, and we'll have even more in the future. And that so in terms of how are we going to address that as we're transforming it, was that something that came through your stakeholder input, concerns about those sorts of things? I mean, for some people to get to some of the current locations is difficult.
Correct.
Excellent.
Mr. Chair, Representative Loeffler, excellent point. And one of the reasons that we learned pretty quickly when we held stakeholder meetings in October, where we just tried to get providers together and counties together, and hospitals together to tell us about their needs, is that there are some very specific regional differences. And the recommendations from the advocates was to go out to the regions and hear from all the stakeholders in each region to try to get regional a regional understanding of what all the various regions need. So we used the Adult Mental Health Initiatives as a forum to do that. And that was the vehicle to get into the various regions across the state, giving us that information from a geographical piece.
Mr. Chair? I appreciate that you worked with those groups, and those are all important, but I didn't hear you saying the families of the people being served and their input and feedback, and that's what we tend to hear from more. And I hope that is, I mean, quite honestly, it's challenging, right, if you have to go to a specialized service area and it's way outside of your geographic area. It may be in a community that doesn't reflect yourself or others. And so I think that as we do long-range planning, we have to think about those kind of concepts. And because obviously maintaining family and friend support is part of success in any kind of treatment regimen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Loeffler, excellent comment. And I will be really quite honest and frank. We were not able to successfully get family members to these meetings across the state for all the reasons that you can imagine. They're working, and we heard that loud and clear, specifically from NAMI, which represents families more than anybody in this state. I think that one of the things that we just will continue to commit to, and I will assure you, we've got to continue to work with all of our stakeholders who represent families and the families themselves to make certain that the system, whatever we do now, isn't laid down in concrete in such a way that it can't continue to flex to meet the needs in an improved way. You're going to hear me talk a little bit about the use of technology that can reach out into geographical regions that have such a disparity or a paucity of services when it comes specifically to psychiatric services. And I think coming back to the metro region, so one of the reasons, honestly, and again, I recognize we've been criticized for this, that we don't have details about an Anoka redesign, because the needs in the metro region are so very specific. And the needs in the West Metro compared to East Metro are different as well. And so we're trying to now, in the next several months, work with individuals over the next several months to try to get a design using some of the components that I'll highlight. So I think we've got a structure to work from, but the details of how this will work in the metro region will be worked out in the next 3 months.
And in the, I kind of just to get you out of here on time, maybe we can just skip like up to 22 and go through the meat of the
absolutely
proposal.
So on page, on slide number 22, this, the first thing to mention here is describing proposed levels of
it's
care.
It's at the top of page 8 for people following that way.
And again, just to remember, just to remind you that the idea here is not to say that these are all levels of care, but this is looking at those individuals who require the very highest levels of care. Is there a better way to develop that system and transform the system, the hospital-based system, so that it is much more efficient, so that individuals remain in hospitals for much less period of time and are at appropriate lower levels of care, fitting their needs better? So there, what's proposed here is the idea of a level one psychiatric care center. A level one psychiatric care center would be modeled after a level one trauma center. We would be using resources currently in existence across the state and try to see through partnership, can we share in resources to create a model in which you have 24 hours of staff in-house psychiatric coverage so that all levels of need could be met with in that facility. So the individual with the highest degree of aggression, the individual with the highest degree of psychosis, the individual with the highest degree of complexities, whether it's medical as well as psychiatric, can be managed at a level one psychiatric care center.
And how many of those are you?
Mr. Chair, we don't have an answer to how many of those, but what is proposed here is that if we start with an estimate of, say, is it possible to have these placed in the state regionally so that every quadrant of the state has at least one within a two-hour radius that's reachable, and how to have those level ones networked with the other level two and other levels of care in that same region.
And that's it's voluntary, like the current trauma system?
Mr. Chair, the idea is that it would be voluntary, however, also would be able to accept commitments. One of the things that...
I mean voluntary in the sense that HCMC would choose to do it as opposed to...
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah, this would not be... We're not proposing that this would be a mandated structure, but what's happening with our hospitals in the level system is a hospital can choose to be a level one or a level two,
right,
or lower based on what their capacity is and what their resources are. And now, what we want to try to model here is it possible, again, coming back to a partnership model, that we can creatively find a way that the cost of providing that level of care is significantly reduced to the community provider because we're providing some of the additional resources for them.
And how many of these are currently state-operated services that would meet that definition?
Currently today, Mr. Chair, we don't have a single state-operated services facility that would meet the definition of level one.
Okay.
Under the level one psychiatric care center, you have Hennepin County Medical Center that has 24 hours of staff in-house psychiatric coverage because they're a residency training program, so they have residents in-house overnight. Regents Hospital also has 24 hours of staffed psychiatric care coverage. Both of those facilities have about 100 beds apiece, 100 psychiatric beds apiece. Several of those beds could be moved into different levels of care, so somebody could transition out of the highest level of care if necessary to a PERTS model if the PERTS model really does fit. When let me jump down to just saying what's different from a level two versus a level one. A level two is essentially what we have in place in the system today, outside of the Hennepin County and Regions hospitals, and you could include the Fairview Hospital as well because they have psychiatric residents on call. And I don't know if they're in-house or not all the time, though. That's the only thing that I'm not bringing that up immediately. A level two. The classic staffing pattern for an inpatient psychiatric unit is there's rounding their psychiatric presence by a psychiatric care provider during the daytime hours, and they are on call in the overnight.
So
and
Hibbing?
Hibbing, for example, would be a level two psychiatric care center. St. Cloud Hospital would be a level two psychiatric care center. Now, they have... There's models. The St. Cloud Hospital, for example, has behavioral access nurses in the emergency room to do assessments and reach a psychiatrist on call, but they don't have a psychiatrist in-house 24 hours a day. So treatment doesn't begin immediately. But if you come into a level one trauma center with a head injury, treatment starts immediately because the staff is in-house. Now,
are there any SOS that meet level two?
Mr. Chair, all of our community behavioral health hospitals would fit under a level two in their current designation. The PERTS with the psychiatric extensive recovery treatment services, it's a holding term because we needed to create something different than the higher level acute inpatient setting for the individuals currently in the state operated services system. We're identifying that this very well is a level of care that it appears could benefit the entire system of care, that our community providers, some of our ERTS providers, may be able to step up to a PERTS level of care if this is truly through our work groups that will be in place in the next 3 months. It's determined really fits the need. We had to begin somewhere, though. So we have chosen to begin with proposing temporarily right now, we are transitioning several of our programs to a PERTS level of care. Essentially, we'll have four, I believe, and I'll walk you through those. One at MEDO. So as part of the MEDO redesign, we would propose that MEDO would really fit under this psychiatric extensive recovery treatment service level of care, in addition to combining some transitional foster homes to the MEDO program, so that there would be a 16-bed PERTS at MEDO with at least 2 4-bed to 5-bed transitional foster homes to allow somebody to transition out of the PERTS level of care into a foster home level of care like we've done at the Pillager model, and then transition back into the community. And the idea there, just specific to MEDO, was that currently the length of stay at MEDO is over a year. The total cost of care at MEDO is about $1 million per treatment episode. So it just feels like, I mean, honestly, our analysis is there's a better way to do this and still meet the individual's needs.
Representative Laffer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, to that point, my understanding is that most of the people at MEDO, a substantial majority, are people of color. They're from the metro area. The 4-bed foster home is being developed in Pillager, Minnesota. I'm sorry, I don't know my geography enough to know even where that is, but it doesn't seem to me like an appropriate location for that kind of a population if that's where they're coming from and that's their cultural identity and background. And, you know, this has to be about the client's needs as much as it is about the managing the finances.
Yes.
And so I think there has to be some really serious discussion about how are you planning to serve the populations that you're doing it, and how are you locating those in the kinds of right supportive communities so that it is accessible to family and others, and that they are not the only people of color in a particular community or one of a very limited number of people. And I think that's an issue. But the other question I have is more of a care question. I've seen some pretty impressive research that shows that medically fragile as well as psychiatrically fragile people, the more that you move them, the more you disrupt the treatment progress. And so the concept of having all these different stepped places and people, you know, kind of constantly moving to a new physical plant and having to adjust to a new set of staff and a new regimen and those sorts of things, I've seen some pretty impressive peer-reviewed research that says that actually extends stay and thwarts progress. And so I'd really like to get some background on how you've been evaluating this from a treatment model and what you have in terms of evidence-based practices that says this is a model that actually will achieve your goals of moving people more effectively to the least restrictive environment and shorten the needed time in treatment.
Excellent.
Mr. Chair and Representative Loeffler, I want to bring you on board because you're asking some tremendous questions that are really appropriate. Let me take the MEDO question first. In regards to the MEDO facility at Cambridge, honestly, right now we will continue to use the facility there because of costs and because we're not proposing to go out and build anything with bricks and mortar today, because we're trying to do this with the resources we have. The transitional foster homes, though, we are not restricted to that particular region. Now, there's a balance in trying to be able to accommodate and use our current workforce and try to disrupt the amount of layoffs that we have proposed that people will be impacted and affected by. But we have ability to place a transitional foster home much closer within communities in which that population served at MEDO comes from. And right now there's no specific location identified of this will be where it is, and that's underway. And in fact, just the fact that you asked the question brings me to an excellent, I mean, it just makes me realize I've got to ask that question to the people working on that to make certain that we are thinking about the community in which the individuals come from for that transitional step. Those clearly could be back in the communities, much closer to where they are from. In regards to the second question, as far as moving across these levels of care, I thank you for asking that question, because I don't want to imply that somebody here has to go from one level to the next level to the next level. The idea is, as we look at the commitments to the commissioner for mental health care, an individual often has been committed to the commissioner and will wind up at the community behavioral hospital, will wind up at MEDO, or will wind up at Anoka. What has not happened is there has not been a total assessment of the individual based on their level of care needs and matching that individual to the right level of care based on their commitment. So somebody could be, if under a commitment, could be admitted directly into, after an evaluation, could be admitted to the right level of care without having to course through these various steps. Somebody could be discharged, just like there are people discharged from an intensive care unit and even a surgical intensive care unit directly to home, people, or they might be discharged from an intensive care unit to a floor, or they might be discharged from an intensive care unit into a rehabilitative program. If we just model that for this end of the spectrum of this level of care, not everybody's going to require a level one psychiatric care center stay in an intensive care unit-like program. Excuse me. Some people might be able to be admitted directly into a PERTS and still get access to the ongoing psychiatric care that's proposed to be provided there, but not have to be admitted to the hospital. The way that I would describe the thinking right now about a PERTS level of care is it would really be like a partial hospitalization level of care, yet with 24 hours of care provided, but the intensive daily treatment could be provided on a daily basis like we do in partial hospitalization programming. That model has reduced hospitalization significantly. What we heard from people across the state is the partial hospitalization alternative wouldn't work because of transportation and housing issues and the overnight care that's still needed for a number of people. So the piece here is that the PERTS is not designed to be a long-term residential level of care, but would be something, if somebody needs stability, much higher intensity of services in order to make them much more successful in a residential level of care or community level of care, this is a model to do that without having to keep them in the hospital for longer. Now, is it possible? There's some interesting possibilities with the pilot amendment in the healthcare reform bill. If any of you read the 2,400 pages, I haven't, but I've read this particular portion of it. There is a pilot to have an alternative to the IMD clause, which will allow individuals to, which will allow a provider to develop a 20 to 25 bed program that might have different levels of care all in the same facility, like a general hospital does. General hospital has an intensive care unit and a rehab unit and a general floor. And that's one of the things that we're trying to see. I don't have the answer that can work, but we're hoping that we can get to some model like that could work much more effectively.
And that's what a PERT would look like? That's one possibility?
One possibility is a PERT may be part of a system that has level one and level two.
So they're not staying here. This is not an inpatient.
No, Mr. Chair, this is proposed to be a stay, overnight stay facility, but not at the locked inpatient level. So it's not at a locked acute inpatient psychiatric unit level.
And what kind of staffing levels are we thinking about here? So we're going to have some kind of psychiatric care that is there part of the day. And then in the evening, will it be staffed with healthcare staff, with nurses and
Mr. Chair, the thinking right now is that in there's a temporary plan as we transition some of these programs into PERT level of care. The staffing pattern, let me preface, is likely to evolve and change based on what we learn. But the thinking here is that there would be an intensive degree of service, treatment services and treatment staff there during the daytime hours. The individuals that would be appropriate for PERT would not need 24 hours of psychiatric nursing care. So there would be a less, it would not be staffed at the highest, it would not be staffed at the acute, to staff an acuity level of inpatient. So you're going to have less staff members involved at providing this level of care. And that's less costly then. And so then I can walk you through how we propose that we can achieve some savings to some of these immediate transitions.
Okay, and we have two other questions, Maria, Representative Root and Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Dr. Sulik. I'm sorry, two questions unrelated. One, would telemedicine play a role in any of this model that you're proposing? And two, unrelated, you mentioned that the cost in the MEDO, it's about, the average day is about a year, $1 million. How many are served in that program?
Mr. Chair and Representative, in regard to the first question, telemedicine and interactive high-speed internet video systems is something that we've been piloting in the DHS currently in the last year. That thinking is completely embedded in this model of thinking. If we had level one psychiatric care centers, we have 24 hours of staff psychiatric care providers, let's say we have five of them in the state. Well, those five can be linked not only with one another, but with the rest of the entire system, to all 149 hospital emergency departments, perhaps to all 87 or more county jails, perhaps all the mobile crisis centers, so that there is a psychiatric team available for consultation, so that we can have more appropriate transition into access to services. It's a way to help solve this problem that continuously comes up of when somebody here thinks this person needs this level of care, but at that receiving end level of care says, they don't meet our criteria. It's a way to get us much better integrated. Now, there's another service proposed to be presented here. Since I jumped around, I don't know where it is in the slides, but it is specific to the access service. What we're proposing that is, in addition to trying to develop these levels of care, to develop an access service for the state. In the GMAC bill that was that has moved forward and I'm assuming has been signed or will be signed, we haven't heard, there is the element of the language, and Representative Murphy can talk to this, regarding the mental health urgent care service. Now, in that language, we were called as state operative services to develop the capacity in the state operative services redesign to have a consultative service available. And so under this access service, what we are proposing is that there would be a staffed adult psychiatrist and child psychiatrist and social worker available to primary care clinics and to the rest of the system, the community mental health system, and to the hospitals, community hospitals and emergency departments, for psychiatric consultation and for rapid access to psychiatric evaluations. Now, we don't need to, what we're proposing is that if we have level one care centers in existence, we can use the staff in-house at the level one care centers as part of a network to provide that same service in the overnight period of time so that we don't have to provide it, so we don't have to staff for just a consultation service. But the access service, we believe, is a significant piece that we honestly really are excited to stand behind and try to get developed. So I do feel that will fill a huge gap. But we've heard from consumers across the state, and I just got a beautiful email today about a consumer from the Southwest region had read the report and said, you know, this doesn't really speak to me. You know, I know that you need to address the services for the individuals with the severe and persistent mental illness. I have a mental illness, but I'm not in that category, but we still need this, this, and this for people like me. And one of the things that was clear is, when I went to the meeting, what I said loud and clear, we need better access to psychiatry, you know, when we need it. And this is a way to try to get us there to a different system. And we are modeling that system. We're not just inventing it. We're modeling it after what some other states, Washington State, Massachusetts, has done, particularly with child psychiatry, because there's been such a shortage. But there's a lot of movement. New York State right now, I'll tell you, their state mental health office is looking at doing something identical to this consultative model. And I just recently got a call on that. So I think that there's some opportunity to get us here to an access service that could really work, using some of the resources that we have in this model.
Representative Murphy had a question.
Mr. Chair.
Oh, you had another question?
The meter question.
Oh, the meter question, yes.
Yes. Oh, thank you.
Sorry.
Go ahead. Yeah, sorry. So I guess it's the same question. So it's the question
dollars.
Was about...
$1 million.
Was about Mito.
Yeah, I can't remember it.
The number, so you had mentioned that it's
about... Oh, how many are at a million?
About $1 million a year.
What is the total number per year served? Do you have that?
The census right now is running for the last 18 months or so. It's been running in the low 20s, and the average length of stay is a little over a year, which would mean that we probably are serving about 30, 35 people a year.
Mr. Chair and Representative, rather than quoting me on that, let me get you the exact number on that, because we have that. I just don't have it at the top of my head.
And I want to make sure that you can get out your thing. I had two other questions. One, thank you for providing that breakdown of the job classifications. It looks like it's only about half of the 200.
Yes, let me, Mr. Chair, let me explain that. That is phase one, step one. Now, phase one, step one, I'm just wondering if I can, let me just address these next two slides.
Sure, sure.
I'll explain that. We had to do some things immediately so that we could manage the $17 million deficit within the remainder of this biennium. We are under a clear charge. By the end of the biennium, we are in a balanced budget. The first thing we proposed to do was to close the Community Behavioral Health Hospital in Cold Spring permanently. We took it offline temporarily in October while we were going through this redesign process until we could really come to some clarity on, is that facility, would it be reopened as a PERT level of care or some other type of service within the community, or can we blend the services with the others in the surrounding areas? We're also proposing to close the Mankato Crisis Center. Now, that's been received with quite some heated reaction, and we've heard it. And honestly, we're working with the counties in that region to try to come up with, is there some alternative that we can come to that still accomplishes the budgetary needs that we have, yet still meets the crisis bed needs? I mean, I'll be real honest with you. I thought that the arguments against closing the Mankato Crisis Center have been appropriate in that, you know, honestly, this is designed to reduce hospitalization. Why would you want to close it? Because it feels like it's a service that's perfectly aligned with everything we see in the report and everything that you all want to try to get to. The issue that it was clearly an outlier for us because this is not a business that the state is in other areas directly. So our adult mental health division funds a lot of crisis services, but the state operated services isn't necessarily providing freestanding state operated crisis stabilization programming. We've not billed for that program. A community provider can bill for it and collect it. And so what we're looking at is there an opportunity to quickly move into some partnerships like we're proposing with the hospital levels of care to allow some services to continue to be in existence, but obviously would be scaled down to something much more affordable that will still accomplish some savings for us. We are proposing to close the community transition services in Eveleth. This is a program that is a 16-bed facility, has an average census of around 10. It's not inert. It's not licensed as a residential treatment program or as a program that is able to achieve, be able to bill for any degree of services. It has been a longer-term treatment and support and housing program. Ideally, it was designed to be transitional in nature. The length of stay has been much longer than anticipated. About 75% of the people in Eveleth are from Hennepin County. That's the data we looked at in the last year. And so what's proposed here is, can that model of providing some services be different than what is currently in existence? Can we close the Eveleth facility? Could we have a transitional foster home in that region and then also work with Hennepin County or other areas in the metro region for the individuals who have traditionally been served there? And then the last immediate change is to transition dental services by closing three of the clinics, leaving two open, and then getting us to a place where we can try to work with the university and other providers for some creative alternative because there is no current funding for dental.
Diane.
Mr. Chair and Dr. Sulik, to that point, my understanding is that these dental services are really providing a unique niche that no one else is willing to step up to, particularly for people who have developmental disabilities, other medical conditions that make them very difficult to treat.
We did spend some time talking about this earlier.
When I was at the other
hearing, so if you want to catch up afterwards, that would be great.
We've had overlapping hearings, so I had to miss part of this.
That was not, I understand.
Mr. Chair and Representative Love, just in response to that quickly, I can say that I'm very happy afterwards at another time to just brief you further on some of the conversation we had earlier, so that you can be caught up on that.
So just on the layoff piece of it then, what about management folks?
If we look at this list, I just saw this morning as it is due, but as you look at this list, the individuals that are at all levels in these programs, at the Cold Spring and at Eveleth and at Mankato Crisis and the dental services, are impacted. So what's here is who would be, the types of positions that would be impacted from these four immediate changes. And then there's also an immediate change to transition the Wilmer and Wadena Community Behavioral Health Hospitals to a PERT level of care temporarily while we work with those regions to determine, is this the right type of model for your region? What type of partnership do we need? Do they need a level one or a level two or a PERT level of care there? But we needed to immediately do something to get us to a level of care that seemed to meet the utilization pattern in that area and get us to some immediate savings. Now, I'm making the assumption, but I'm going to say this out loud, and Michael can correct me if, Mike, this includes, I'm assuming this includes what Wilmer and Wadena
does
as well. So in this step one, part of step one and then the beginning of step two, these are the total number of individuals in their classifications that would be impacted by layoffs. Remember that there's bumps within the system due to seniority, so we don't know exactly who ultimately will be the person impacted.
Okay, and I said, because I'm hearing that some of the management level positions have already kind of found their way to other management level positions. So, I mean, is there any reduction in the actual number of, I don't know if you use FTEs as your measure, in kind of management as opposed to direct service provision? If that question even makes sense.
Do you want to comment on that?
Well, Mr. Chair, the residential program management senior is a typical classification that we use, and you'll notice there's two individuals, two filled positions that are being eliminated in this first round. There's a number of positions that over the last year we have of supervisory and managers we have not filled, knowing that this was coming. I don't have those numbers today, but I can get you those numbers.
Okay.
Well, Mr. Chair, as I look at this list as well, I see that there are supervisors. There's a supervisory class as well impacted, as well as management, as well as the clinical staff, as well as the direct care staff. I'm happy to look at that and try to understand that better.
And the last question I have is, because we need to move some other testifiers too, is is it the department's position that this redesign is within the executive branch authority without any, without the legislature needing to act?
Mr. Chair, right now the department's position is our analysis to date, and we may get corrected on this, but our analysis to date is what is proposed here does not need legislative approval, although we want to be completely collaborative with you all. However, there is something in legislation that we have to address, and that is there is no layoff language for Mito and Anoka. And in the total redesign proposal, which includes moving a unit from Anoka to the the nursing facility in St. Peter that has been under purely a forensic system, we're broadening that to be able to serve two different populations and serving the broader adult mental health unit. There's a unit at Anoka that would be very appropriate to be served in that nursing facility. That will involve people either moving or driving. It's outside of a 35-mile radius. We'd probably have to lay them off and rehire them in St. Peter. There is no layoff language at Anoka. And we are working with the bargaining units, but we may very well need to be coming back addressing that issue in regards to that. We also have asked a complete analysis of everything that we're proposing here and try to figure out, is there anything that we've missed that clearly needs to be brought forward for legislation?
And the plan is on the...
I mentioned the no layoff language at NEDO as well. So yeah. There's no... That's the other area that we're aware of that we have to address.
And the timeline on this, all this is, this, at least this phase one is going to be done by May 1st, is the plan?
Mr. Chair, the timeline is that the immediate changes done by May 1st are driven because of the budget needs that we have. We wanted our closures and transitions in the programs to be aligned with this broader vision of where we're going. The broader vision of where we're going is going to occur over the next several months, 15 months to 3-year period of time at least. There's still some additional things that have to be accomplished within that 15-month period. We have a slide here that says, honestly, we haven't done a good job explaining the idea behind the Anoka facility, but the idea is that by examining level one, level two, and PERTS levels of care and the entire array of community levels of care across the metro region, what could work different at Anoka so that there are perhaps a collaborative unit with Hennepin County Medical Center, with Regions and Fairview and others, so that every service is ultimately optimizing all funding sources.
Right. Mr. Chair, the next phase, which would impact both Anoka and the Cambridge program, as well as the Minnesota New Rehab up at Brainerd, those numbers are not on this page because of the no layoff language that needs to get resolved. So we're anticipating the actions on those are probably a month or so behind. But those still will need to happen in order for us to meet our budget pressures.
And so that would make up for the additional 100?
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Okay, Representative Fritz had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm just looking at the numbers of layoffs here, and you talked about the management, one or two, or the supervisors, one or two folks, but I'm looking at your part-time RNs. There's 14 positions there. Plus the 6, and then you've got the LPNs up here with 9 part-time and 6 full-time, and human service techs at 10 full-time and 4 part-time. So I'm wondering, on the part-time, is that like 3-quarter time, or how much, can you tell me what that is? The is it 3-quarter half?
Thank you. Mr. Chair, Representative, I can get you that breakdown, but typically it's either part-time is either 0.5 or 0.8, but I can get you that breakdown.
And then you're working with the, Dr. Salisa, you're working with the bargaining units to place these folks in another facility or in a level one or two. How soon do you think that would happen?
Mr. Chair, Representative, these are the immediate changes that we are looking at, what positions they can fit into in our existing structure or in the new services we're creating now. Not necessarily level one, level two, because as Dr. Suwaka said, that's coming down the road over the next either months or year or two or three. But for example, on any given day, and currently we have over 100 vacancies in state operated services. We employ over 4,300 people. So we have vacancies that occur. Many of the vacancies are in classifications that are being impacted by the job reduction. So we're working with the bargaining units to make sure that people know what vacancies are available and can access them accordingly.
What if we don't? Are you done?
Another question I have is then these folks will be employed first.
Mr. Tesner.
Mr. Chair, Representative, these are the numbers of positions that will go away. All right, so there'll be 94 positions that go away. Mm-hmm. It's not possible today to tell you how many of these people will claim a job in our system somewhere until that bidding process and the claiming process occurs. But at this point, I believe there's somewhere over 70 positions, similar positions that are being created in these new services or different services we're providing or will be providing, and there's over 100 vacancies in our system. So at the end of the bidding and the claiming process and people deciding if they're willing to move and all the difficult choices people have to make, once they're done, we'll have a sense of how many people claimed a job and are still with us versus how many are no longer with us.
Okay. President Laughlin.
Thank you.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm a little still trying to sort this out, because on the page on slide, I guess it's 35 on page 12, it says there's going to be 90 new FTEs created. Mm-hmm. And I assume that anyone in this reconfiguring would have a chance at those, but what we're, it's still unclear to me is whether the timing lines up. And then I'd like to know what kind of support you're offering people who would choose to geographically move to be closer to the new location, if that's, if something isn't available in their current service area. I have understood from other state employees who've had to bump or been relocated that they're, that the state doesn't have a consistent policy in helping people with that, depending upon the circumstances, and I think that's important to discuss as well.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the bargaining unit agreements that we've entered into speak to the whole layoff and bumping and claiming, as well as relocation expenses. Those are relatively clearly prescribed in the agreements. There may be differences between the nurses' union and AFSCME and MAPE and such. None come to mind, but there may be some differences there. There are situations where we do have to carefully negotiate different agreements across seniority units to make sure people have that are in one seniority unit can get to another seniority unit if they're bumped over here and claim jobs over there. And we are in conversations as recently as this morning where I know there's a rub and we're going to have to work those out. We're at the table with them, and we intend to, as much as we can practically do, ensure that people that are being negatively impacted have access to jobs that they're capable and qualified for and are interested, even if it includes them moving.
Representative Fritz.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And to that point, absolutely we are. You know, this is the times that we are in, the recession. So we're about saving jobs. That's our job here, and yours as well. So I wish you all the best and continue to work with the bargaining units going forward. Because and the math doesn't seem to add up, though, for me, because you are saying that you have 103 job openings. And you have 90 some here. So you have the positions available for those, all of those folks. There will be some bumping and some seniority and some retirements, but I don't know that there'll be a lot of those.
Madam Chair, Representative Fritz. People have to make choices, so it's really hard to say today exactly how many people will as they go through the process, will get what they want and where they're going to get. But we are going to continue to work with people. You know, I want to emphasize the changes that we're making are not a reflection of the capabilities or competencies of our staff. It is our intent to save as many jobs as we can, because these are people who are dedicated to working with the populations we serve and who do good work. So we are highly motivated to keep as many people in jobs and as close to the job and as close to where that job is to where they live as possible.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Resident Ward, did you want to? And then I'm staying here till 12:30, so we are going to get through all the testimony. I may be the only one, but.
Okay. Well, Mr. Chair, I'll try not to take a lot of your time, and I appreciate, Mr. Chair and members, the ability to come before your committee and just give some feedback on the redesign program. And member, and Mr. Chair, there's a lot of questions on this. As I had attended the hearing the other day and today, as I was able to attend a little bit, there still continues to be a lot of questions, and a lot of them regarding jobs. And it is ironic to me that as we in the House and the Senate and in the legislature work to create jobs, you know, this plan has put in jeopardy 200 plus or 200 more or whatever the number is of jobs. And Mr. Chair, members, I want you to know that I just don't speak from, you know, just what I read. I attended the stakeholder meeting. I have asked Mr. Tesner, I don't know where he went, Mr. Tesner and Dr. Sulik to come into my office and talk about this redesign plan over and over and over, and we have. And they have, and I appreciate the fact that they've been open and honest with me. But Mr. Chair, I really, the stakeholder meeting I attended in Brainerd, and I have the notes from that, you know, talk about a lot of concerns they had, and I don't see any of those concerns being addressed within the redesign plan. So I wonder how much truly that the public and that the line, the people with the boots on the ground actually were listened to. you know, as far as their ideas. And Mr. Chair, I just like to say, let's look at the history of DHS and SOS and their planning. You know, they went from they went to the community-based hospitals, the CBHHs, and built 10 of them with 16-bed capacity, and the capacity's been at about 80 beds. And then, you know, they moved programs from one campus to another campus that has very specialized. We had what's called the Children Adolescent Behavior Health Services Program, Mr. Chair, that you remember, that was very specialized training for the severe depressed and suicidal juveniles in the state. That was a well-known program, and they moved it from Brainerd to Willmar, making it very difficult for the northern half of the state to then receive services in this very specialized area. It seems to me that the plans that they have, you know, that has the plans that they have done in the past has created part of the $15 to $17 million problem that we have. And so, Mr. Chair, all I wanted to say is because of the jobs, because of the questions, because of a plan that still is not has a lot of ambiguity and questions about it, then maybe we just slow down a little bit. Maybe we just try to take it in pieces, or maybe we don't try to implement the whole thing at one time. You know, maybe we try to, again, maybe having a futuristic and visionary plan and actually listening to the people in the state of Minnesota as far as their input. Maybe let's just take it a little bit as a time. In the hearing on Tuesday, I heard Dr. Sulik quote, and I quote him saying, there has been much progress in staff morale. And the people in my district, Mr. Chair and members, there's no progress in staff morale. There's a TBI unit that's saying, you know, we don't have a layoff clause, a guarantee. We have concerns about the jobs and about the programs and about the great service and work that we do in our program. So, Mr. Chair, I just ask that we maybe take a little slower pace in this whole plan. And I thank you for your time.
Thank you. Mr. McAfee. And we have about seven more people to go. So,
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Mark McAfee, legislative representative of AFSCME Council 5. Point one, the redesign plan is driven by economics rather than sound long-range planning. The $17 million divide that needs to be crossed was caused in part by the governor's unallotments, as you've already discussed, and refusal to support new revenue. The failure to get all the CBHHs certified by CMS is a case in point. These have been open for a few years. Point two, does the redesign improve access and quality of care? There's a lot of intent, but it sure doesn't seem to with respect to dental care. And I think when you're, for those most interested in that, you'll want to take a look at, if I've got the right program, the unallotment on the critical access dental, you're aware of that, so that it became clear there's not a great and quick option to, if we close these state clinics, to pick up those clients. Point three, the effort to partner with community health systems, hospitals, mental health centers, health plans, etc., is just getting underway. Phase two is at the intention stage. Execution seems uncertain. The cuts inflicted by the administration through unallotment and proposed budget cuts to county and community mental health services leaves a moon-like landscape on which to land this initiative. Partners need money to collaborate, and that will not be easy to come by. The whole battle over GMC will be a tough act to follow. There really haven't been any handshake deals to date that we're aware of. We think the redesign report and description of our employees as skilled, compassionate, dedicated for care, providing care for individuals with the most acute needs in the state is accurate. Some of the folks are here today, as was acknowledged. Some are worried about losing their jobs. All are concerned about what happens to the clients they serve. Point five, we wish our workers had more of a voice and that their opinions were more valued. It's true that there was a sort of electronic suggestion box for cost-saving ideas. Some ideas were forthcoming but remain a secret. Let's get those out on the table. Supposedly 1,000 people participated roughly in the stakeholder meetings, but these were not targeted to include our workers. A few of our people may have showed up at them, but they weren't identified as a specific group. Employees were consulted little and late. Most discussion, and it's an ongoing pattern, comes through labor management meetings. With our exclusive representatives informed after decisions have been made and with little or no chance for input. There is a better way. Quality principles would dictate if employees have security, they're open to change. If they have a voice, they're open to innovation. And hopefully in the future we will have that one day. Point six, a lot of uncertainties remain about clear plans about some of these programs. Now you heard the discussion. There's a major effort here to move to PERTs, you know, and we're not sure exactly how these will be designed and operating and what staffing ratios we'll use. And I'll point out to you that just this week, and I think it's in the PowerPoint you may have received, just this week he started meeting with a psychiatric level of cares work group, and one of their charges is to develop and design levels of 1, 2, and 3 PERTs. It's good they're bringing that group together, but in effect, this is a design-build project. And if you're on the Transportation Committee, you know what that might mean. Point 7, as we move from to Phase 1, Part 2, redesign of, you talked about MEDO and you talked about ANOCA. The first thing we ask is, where do the clients go, the most difficult to serve? There is no fast place to put those folks. Also, I heard discussion, we feel strongly and we appreciate some of the members on this committee that, you know, how did we get that no layoff language as a result of this restructuring? Last session, the focus was on downsizing ANOCA and downsizing MEDO. In the conference committee then to give some comfort, this no layoff legislation language is put in. We feel very strongly, while the department has, you know, from time to time will approach us, we feel very strongly though until something as good or better comes along that we oppose very strongly repealing that language that's in the bill that had been signed by the governor last year. Just a couple more points. On the layoffs, one point we want to make, I've seen, our folks, by the way, had gotten from HR, had gotten some information. The sheet that was passed out indicates it'll go just a bit beyond what we had received. You can see even on the sheet you've gotten that we've had a major push moving towards part-time employment. So when we talk about cutting FTEs, it can certainly affect more than one job. It looks like on the sheet you have in Phase 1, we'll probably have about 50 AFSCME jobs affected. If we go through the whole plan for Parts 1 and 2, well, then they're talking about 220 FTEs. And because of the part-time, we're guessing that could affect as many as 300 people. So finally, you know, there seems to be no detailed plan for phases 2 and 3. Are we flying to the moon or flying blind? It's going to take good, sound planning, and we hope, I'll echo what Representative Ward said, you may want to slow down a bit. I mean, there is a money issue we have to deal with, but we need to do it right, and we need the legislature and not just the governor involved. And finally, we'd say certainly sooner or later we're going to need revenue to help deal with this issue. So stop with that, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Ms. Everolden. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Sue Abderholden, Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota. It is no secret that NAMI Minnesota, along with all the other mental health organizations, have grave concerns with the SOS report. First of all, we do believe it's disingenuous to cut $17 million from the mental health system and call it a transformation. You appropriated $34 million in 2007, which was the largest infusion of mental health dollars, new dollars, into our system in our state's history. So how can you now cut half of it and say we're transforming the mental health system? Our mental health system is woefully underfunded, and so cutting $17 million is simply devastating, not transformative. And Assistant Commissioner Sulik was correct to say that we're furious, but I assure you we are not confused by the report. Second, the mental health community is disappointed that the department did not early on embrace engaging and collaborating with the mental health community in their decisions on SOS. Last summer, the department held internal meetings to decide what to do, and it wasn't until October that stakeholder meetings were held, and we received an 8-day notice for that meeting. NAMI then sent a letter to the commissioner on October 15th about the lack of involvement of individuals living with mental illnesses and their families. We then testified to the lack of engagement here in this committee on November 4th. DHS then finally called a meeting with the mental health community on November 9th. A meeting to plan public input was held on November 19th and again on December 21st, with the very first regional meeting being held on January 8th. I want to point out that the focus was never on children's mental health services, which is why there were no families of children who attended any of the hearings. And these meetings were also held during the day, which made it difficult for families to take off of work to be involved. The stakeholders were invited back to a meeting on February 22nd to review the input from the meetings. Throughout all of this time, I have to say that DHS has not been able to understand the difference between gathering input and actually collaborating with us on a redesign. Third, we believe that DHS has not given fair consideration to the input that was provided, and their report offers little details as to what these models are and how they will be funded, and they do have a handout. SOS administration knew what they wanted to do, and you'll see that the recommendations from the internal work group are, but for one, contained in the final report. The handout also has a list of questions developed by the mental health community and a list of the recommendations from the other reports that we've worked on. And I would suggest that if you go through and check off the recommendations that are in the DHS SOS report, I think it'll become clear to you that the department used their recommendations from last summer and not the ones that we all provided. If you look at the intensive needs report from last session, you'll see that few, if any, of those recommendations were adopted. Both on the children's and adult services side, there's a recognition of the need to address people who have the most intense issues, such as medically complex, aggressive behaviors, dual disorders, such as mental illness, along with developmental disabilities, chemical dependency, or traumatic brain injury. These concerns were raised at the regional hearings, but the recommendations from that intensive needs report and the community hearings were to create long-term models of providing treatment and services in the community, not in a hospital and not in a short-term residential facility. SOS is recommending that level one hospitals be created around the state, but where are we going to find hospitalist psychiatrists to staff this model? We have beds that go empty in the metro area due to lack of psychiatrists. Why will hospitals want to become level one hospitals when many will be losing money due to the GMC changes? We learned yesterday that this would only be medical assistance patients, and hospitals wouldn't incur costs unless they had a patient. But how do you build an infrastructure for a level one hospital system without any costs? It didn't make sense to us. You might remember us testifying here 2 years ago, urging you to not build up the hospital level of care for children or adults because it's the highest cost part of our system and the level that they use for the very least amount of their time. People, even with these complex issues, will spend most of their time in the community, and that is where the gap is, not at the hospital level of care. So what services do we need to develop them that will keep them there and not back in the hospital? And that is, again, those long-term residential services. I do want to mention that the proposal that, or the project, you know, appropriation that's in the federal health reform bill does not apply to publicly owned facilities. So that will not help out the state-operated services. They also recommend these new things called PERTs. And so what they're really going to do is take the nearly empty beds at the CBHHs and make them a PERT. If the CBHHs couldn't care for these people with medically complex issues or aggressive behaviors now, then how can you decrease the staffing, put a new name on the program, and then be able to serve these people? We have not seen any real data. We've been told that there are around 60-some people at Anoka who don't need that level of care. When asked how many of them were from Greater Minnesota, it could be maybe 20%. So then when you look at maybe there are 90, 120 bed days, you know, it doesn't, we're still going to have empty beds. And we, you know, then they said they're going to move this in, integrate it with the community, but we contacted IRTS providers, so they would might be people who maybe couldn't serve them there, and so maybe would put them in these new PERTs, and none of them have been contacted. So, I, you know, frankly, if I were to bring a proposal to my little board and say, here's what I want to do, and I had no numbers, they would turn me down. I've been an advocate for people who have used the state system for almost 30 years, and it a little felt like a deja vu when I saw Senator Samuelson in the audience, because he and I have struggled over this issue over the last couple of years, many years. And I'm always nervous when the state builds things, because they then want to operate it forever, even if its usefulness has gone away. And I think that was true for the institutions, and it's now true for the CBHHs. So the state has these empty beds, and they're going to try to fill them. The problem is that if your system is so inflexible that it can't work with others in the community and cannot change quickly to meet the needs, it's doomed to failure. We saw that with the CBHHs. We have been complaining for years about their centralized admission process, and even as late as December, they were still focusing on centralized admission. So, you know, they just don't want to change. There is nothing in this report that assures us that the problems with the CBHHs having empty beds won't be repeated over and over again. There's nothing in this report that holds them responsible for their budget so that their history of overspending and underserving won't happen again. NAMI would like to know how much was projected to be generated by the CBHHs and how much was actually generated to see how far they were off. We'd also like to know why Anoka, which actually has a waiting list, is only able to fill and staff 157 of their 200 beds. And we'd like to know why the Mankato Crisis Center, which has served as much or more people than all the CBHHs combined, was the one slated for closure. As one of our board members stated last week, it's a bureaucratic shuffle board, a kind of take care of us before we take care of them. One of the elephants in the room is that, what is the role of state-operated services? It used to be the only game in town. Now it's a third of the funding and even less in terms of people served. Shouldn't there have been agreement on the role before this so-called transformation? Is SOS a safety net to provide treatment and services to those individuals that are not served by the community providers, either because they can't or aren't paid enough to do so, or is it a specialized health system that operates in its own silo, and their doors, there's now big signs outside the state-operated services that says specialized healthcare services. There's been no discussion and no agreement on this. We were, as a community, frankly surprised that there was nothing on Anoka. I mean, you did require that last legislative session. I have been contacted by several staff from Anoka, and I want to make it clear that it's not Dave Hartford, who's head of Anoka and on my board. He is too much of a stand-up guy to do that. But we did hear from people who said, you know, they've collected data, they have ideas, and they've never been contacted. And so, you know, we've had a long time to be able to do that. The recommendations you see were not developed with the mental health community, but really by SOS staff and now consultants from other states. Two of the consultants are psychiatrists, so, you know, give someone a hammer and everything looks like a nail. And they're from states that, frankly, don't have strong county governments, Vermont and Massachusetts. I think SOS has proposed a very medical model, and while we, of all people, think you need to treat mental illness as a regular illness, we also need to develop those long-term supports in the community. I'll remind members that the mental health community was able to develop the 2007 mental health initiative without the help of out-of-state consultants, and that we were at the table going over every comma and every period. We feel very disappointed with the SOS report and have no faith that this plan will be successful.
Thank you. My paper says good morning, but I think it's afternoon. So thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Ed Idy. I'm the executive director of the Mental Health Association. I'm going to share information that has been shared with me from people all around the state that is an advocacy organization I feel compelled to do. The SOS redesign is a significant change, but we have no idea how significant. Is it transformational? We don't know. It was clear from the meetings I attended during this listening process that there was a great deal of frustration around the state in regard to access to services. People had to travel all over the state to visit their loved ones in a faraway facility. People couldn't understand why a nearby CBHH had empty beds but no one could get in. It appears, listening to the testimony here and in other committees, that SOS is a set of services that are not necessarily integrated and that very few people fully understand. It is not user-friendly nor recovery-based. It appears often to be simply a holding pen for people no one wants to serve. Its costs are high per patient and reimbursements poor and length of stay long. Plus, it doesn't generate adequate federal match dollars and has to give its revenue to the general fund instead of return it to its services. It needs to be redesigned, but it needs to be done thoughtfully. Cutting $17 million is not redesign. It is, as Senator Sharon stated, degradation. Two Tuesdays ago, I was in St. James meeting with the local advisory council concerning legislative issues. When we got to SOS redesign, the expressions on people's faces changed. Everyone was very upset about the potential cuts that had been released to the press that morning. As we're sitting there, a Watonwan County staff person received an email from a peer in Blue Earth County informing her that the Mankato Crisis Program was being closed May 5th. That was the morning of the press release. Many of the people in the room had worked on developing a crisis center and were mad about the decision. In fact, it felt like they were taking their anger and frustration out on me. It's a good thing Mike Tesner wasn't in the room. Then on Thursday, I met with the Sherburne County LAC. The issue of SOS redesign compared to other legislation, including the GAMC cuts or options, was very tense. Throughout the state, people feel like their ideas were not listened to and decisions had already been made concerning cuts to services. It is not looked upon as transformation, but simply cuts. I received a call last week from a woman, a consumer, who has been following our updates on the SOS plans. She needed some clarification about the cuts and started with the Level 1 trauma centers. She's afraid the current psych wards will close and be replaced with the new hospitals, leaving people with fewer options. After we resolved that fear, she asked a great question about metrics and how we will measure the effectiveness of these changes or cuts to services. I thought that was a really smart idea of hers, and I thought I'd bring the concept forward to you. How will we know if these cuts are implemented that they are successful? Her point is that redesign should be thoughtful, not a knee-jerk reaction. Her concern was that she understands cost savings in the current deficit are necessary, but what will the long-term impact be on people's health? Transformation is necessary in how we provide mental health services. Recovery and resiliency allows people to be involved with their health care. Better access is critical. Developing partnerships to provide services in local communities are important. I agree with all that. But how do we know this will work? This needs to be a statewide discussion with thoughtful consideration and complete buy-in by everyone. This all started last year with this committee asking for a redesign of Anoka and moving those beds elsewhere in the metro area. The current plan has morphed into drastic cuts to balance the budget. What happened to the Anoka beds? That is a question that has been raised at the Hennepin County LAC meeting, the Dakota County LAC meeting, and the Sherburne County LAC meeting that I attended. As this process moves forward, and however it will look in the final analysis, please continue to ask the tough questions and make certain the final result is better services to the people of the state. I met yesterday with the Rice County LAC. They refer to the Mankato Crisis Center as the hub. They view it as a significant resource for their community and, in fact, have a great working relationship throughout the region. Once again, they feel like their voices were not heard. I heard something there that was interesting in regard to dollars. They told me that it was projected that the Mankato Crisis Center would generate $400,000 in income, and it actually generated $90,000 in income, which appears to be fairly typical of SOS services. If I did that, as Sue talked about, if I had an idea like that and brought it to my board, I'd be out of a job. That's just poor management all the way around. They see the proposal for more local ownership of the Mankato Crisis Center as perhaps an alternative. Maybe we can take it away from SOS and let the locals run it because they could probably generate federal matching dollars. Thank you very much for listening.
And I think that's what they're thinking about. So, all right, members, if you want to go to session, you can. We're going to keep going, though, even though I don't think we're allowed to, but we're going to do that. So, Mr. Brand.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. My name is Ron Brand. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Association of Community Mental Health Programs. And I'll make a few comments here. I have prepared a written text which is available to all of you.
Yeah, thank you.
We're cautiously optimistic, how's that for a phrase, about the SOS redesign. But really that depends a lot on how this idea of partnerships evolves and the details about that. We don't know a lot about how that would work in practice. Our members were involved in in some of the local or regional meetings, and we can see the evolving role of the state-operated services that has been described to you and have been involved in this sort of discussion over the past 25 years. SOS is an important part of the system. However, it's just one part of the system. And it's a, and so it's really easy to hear all this discussion and think that that is the whole system, but it's really only one part. For example, the community behavioral health hospitals served 1,600 people last year in a typical year. Collectively, our association members annually serve over 125,000 people and 16,000 people with serious persistent mental illness who actually have clinical profiles that are very similar to many of the people in the community behavioral health hospitals. Our members also provide a significant part of the services for children. The regions in the state vary tremendously, and so any of these redesign efforts need to really take into account the regional differences in how services might be best implemented or operated and how the state relates to the local systems of care and sorts out its role as a payer versus its role as a provider. And those are really different. The metro area has some unique problems and will require some, I think, some very, very careful special attention because of the, it already has some of the level one services and needs some development about the interrelationships between the levels of care. That's going to take some effort. There's a lot of pressures that are driving change in SOS, and you've already heard about those. There's been overspending, there's been unallotments, and there's changes in community practice. Currently, the hospitals are outside of the Anoka Hospital, they're operating about half capacity. Why? Arguably, I think we're seeing a return on the investment that has been made by the state and by the state health plans. Arguably, improved medications, rate increases for critical access providers have allowed them to add additional psychiatrists, provide better outpatient services in community mental health centers. We've developed ACT services and mobile crisis services, residential crisis services, a number of things that have had a significant impact on managing these people that have chronic and complex conditions. Overall, Dr. Sulik is correct. It's Minnesota spends more as a proportion on our inpatient care versus outpatient and community-based services, and we probably have a higher use of the use of the court system through civil commitment as a gateway into getting help. We're very concerned about the interaction of the SOS redesign plan combined with the cuts in the governor's budget, and we've talked about that. But collectively, I just want you to know that you put those together and we're talking about $50 million worth of cuts that would affect us. And we believe that it would seriously harm the infrastructure of some of the community programs. I know they don't want to do that, but it's inevitable. It's difficult knowing how these things play out in practice. It's just difficult to see how, wake up at night worrying about it, I guess. In my written testimony, I list a number of the kinds of changes that are going on. $7.5 million in the GAMC bill, another $9 million of adult grants in the governor's budget, about $12 million in CCSA, the community block grant, goes to counties, and about 10% of county aid goes into the mental health system. And these things add up. I have examples of specific organizations and how the GMC changes would affect them. I mean, one of them, and here in the Twin Cities, People Incorporated says that they would have a loss of $1.5 million in their residential crisis services, case management, and other things. Others talk about similar things. There's just been kind of a disconnect, I think, as some of the historically and in this plan, between the state's policy and funding or payer role and the state's provider role. It's just very hard to think of the state as a provider operating sort of like the VA health system or the Bethesda Hospital or Gillette Hospital system. We really need to think of this as a service that's integrated as part of a system of care where we're coordinating the health and social services for people. And it's so easy for them to dominate a region, and it's very hard to compete with free in a local situation. So oftentimes there are gaps in services that the SOS proposes to fill, but the gaps in services are the direct result of state policies or payment methods that help create and foster those gaps. And I think there are tremendous opportunities to make some changes in how we do Medicaid and how we do some of our funding that would enable the community providers to provide a benefit to people that would be flexible and that would draw down additional federal financial participation and attract third-party payments if that was redesigned properly. Essentially, what we have here is the state taking opportunity to fill gaps that are created by the state's own policies. I mean, you look at it, we have limits on foster care, there's limits on caddy waivers, there's limits in how we do Medicaid reimbursement, et cetera. So we've had some good experiences being partners with SOS. Some of our members report very good experiences where they've shared psychiatrists, they've hired them jointly, where they have had state staff who have been assigned to work at the community mental health centers and have worked side by side with other staff on ACT teams or as part of mobile crisis teams or other kinds of services that helped augment and enhance that local systems of care ability. And those things, that sort of thing is possible, and it enables them to extend further geographically or to be able to have longer hours or serve more people. Those things are possible. It's, the truth is most of the community health organizations could provide most of the non-hospital services that we have here, and in fact, some of the existing ERTS programs that our members operate have a higher level of staffing than some of the CBHs that they described. That really has to do with how they set up the program and how the payments work. There are around six different crisis centers similar to what is done in the Mankato area that community providers operate, and they do it quite successfully and have contracts with all the major health plans as well as collecting revenue from the state medical assistance program.
So how did that crisis center get started?
Best ask them that question. I think it had to do with an earlier redesign and change that occurred at the St. Peter campus at the time that the Moose Lake, it goes back several years ago. The SOS has had a long history of overestimating the numbers of beds that were going to be needed and developing models that would fit the local needs and be able to adjust, you've heard this before, and be able to meet the requirements of third-party payers. There's our potential efficiencies for shared staffing or between having staff from an outpatient community-based program be able to surge to help strengthen a residential program when needed because when you have people who are more complex or more difficult. But we just wonder, how are local partnerships be structured? How do they be financed? What capabilities would be expected? Is it possible to redirect some of the funds that we're now spending through appropriations to the SOS to enhance our Medicaid or our other programs that allow for more flexibility and draw down better federal financial participation? We think there's a great opportunity to take advantage of, a horrible situation to try to be creative. We can probably develop some partnerships, but we need to be at the table, and a lot of that has to be done at a local level in order to figure out something that works with the system of care. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee staff. My name is Mary Regan. I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Council of Child Caring Agencies, and I'm just here to talk very briefly about some concerns about the proposal to make changes in the child and adolescent behavioral health services area under state-operated services. When all of this started to get talked about last fall, we met with the department, and we were assured that there were no plans to change this service. That didn't mean we didn't think there should be some plans to change the service, but we were told there were no plans to change the service. So we didn't get involved in any of the feedback focus groups. And as you've heard before, there weren't families involved. I think something that's important to remember is a little bit of the history about this program. CABS was shifted from an appropriation-based program to an enterprise program in 2002 and switched back last year with an $8 million appropriation, redesigned last year with a focus on very intensive kids, multiple problems. And at the time, we were assured that the kids that my members can't serve, my members of the residential treatment centers, mental health certified in the community, typically are the very complicated kids who have accompanying very aggressive behavior. Program opens with the new targeted populations, and they would not take aggressive kids. And when we asked about that, and when counties asked about that, we were told that they weren't equipped to handle them. The per diem for that program is $1,600 a day. My members provide mental health services, residential treatment, at an average cost of $240 a day. We can't deal with those kids because we don't have the staff to deal with them. It's very confusing to understand why they can't deal with that level of care.
Where are those now?
Where are the kids?
No, the cats.
Wilmer is it.
Is that Wilmer's the only one?
And in this proposal, they're proposing to change the CABS program from the current licensure as a hospital to a PERT.
Right.
What is a PERT? If the federal government couldn't understand what a community behavioral health hospital was, how are they going to understand what a PERT is? And if we can't get funding for that, we are going to be in the same soup that we're in with the CBHHs.
So really at $1,600 a day in those CABS. Part of that is because they're not full, I take it. So you're spreading overhead over a much broader. Okay.
Correct.
Now, are there enough kids to fill those beds?
There are kids in detention centers with severe mental illness because nobody else can handle them physically. There are kids out of state in programs in Utah and other places because nobody can handle them in the state.
And they're saying, and they're not going there because
they won't take.
Saying they won't take.
What are the new foster care services? They're talking about transitional foster care services.
Can I just, one more question. So what would they, I suppose it's for them to ask, but what would they need? Higher staffing levels? Or we don't know.
I know what my members would need. They would need higher staffing levels. They might need a little more capacity for single rooms, things like that in their programs. But I don't think they'd need $1,600 a day. I think they could do it for quite a bit less than that. The other question we have is the foster care services that are being talked about being developed. You put a moratorium in place last year on new corporate foster care, which is what these services would be. So I don't know if the state doesn't have to comply with that, if they can open new foster care services.
That's what PERTs would be, or the MEDO things?
No, MEDO was one example, but they've also talked about it in the context of children's services.
Okay.
Establishing more foster care. How would this be funded? You have delayed the implementation of therapeutic foster care for the last few years, making it a Medicaid-funded service in order to help deal with preserving existing services. We really think it's important not to create more state-operated programs. They're more expensive, less flexible, and set up obligations to continue, regardless of effectiveness or utilization. We are willing to work with stakeholders, including the state, on assessing the need for new services and evaluating who can provide those services in the most cost-effective manner, and in securing an effective continuum of care across the state. We do think there needs to be a safety net for children.
So the proposal, then, is... I mean, is it taking some of your members' operations away or kind of supplanting them? Or maybe said another way, that your members could fill some of these needs, is what you're saying?
I think our members potentially could fill some of these needs, but it's not clear what the plan is, so we're not sure what they're going.
Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate the opportunity to make some comments to you. My name is Dick Dirks. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Dental Association. The Minnesota Dental Association represents about 80% of the dentists in the state, about 3,100 dentists. Within the report on the proposal to redesign the SOS programs is a plan to close all five state-operated dental clinics. In just 5 weeks, Fergus Falls, Wilmer, and Cambridge will be closed. And the other two, Brainerd and Faribault, would be closed in 12 to 15 months. You have heard that they will be kept open, but that only means they'll be kept open until they're closed, with the plan to close them being in 12 to 15 months. These clinics serve the most vulnerable of our state citizens, adults who are permanently developmentally disabled. In other words, those patients who should be protected will be abandoned if these five clinics are closed. The severe cutbacks to the Critical Access Dental Provider Funding Program and to the adult benefit set make a transition to community care extremely unlikely. It sounds like a good plan, but there's already a dental access problem, and for the developmentally disabled to get placed when regular children and adults can't get placed, and now with the new cutbacks, is extremely unlikely. To think that a dentist, a regular dentist, dental office and clinic can step in and provide this kind of care is not really possible. And that's why these five clinics have existed and need to continue. For example, one of the kinds of care that these clinics provide that goes above and beyond a normal dental clinic is the fact that the patients that they see have difficulty just keeping their teeth clean. Now, that sounds like a basic service, but for these patients, it's critical. Just this morning, before I came over here for this hearing, I had the parents of a young adult who lives in Fergus Falls and is treated there, who needs to go in at least every 3 to 4 months to have his teeth cleaned, because without that, he'll lose his remaining teeth, and they're concerned about his ability to even continue to eat and chew well, and he needs to be sedated in order to have any kind of dental treatment whatsoever, and so they're quite concerned about his ability. About 25% of these patients have to go under general sedation to receive any dental care at all. And for other alternative community providers to provide that service, many of them don't do it at all, and for them to be able to do it, and especially outside of a hospital setting, is very difficult. Two of these five clinics have hospital-based programs. Fergus Falls and Faribault have a hospital relationship, and without that continuing, that 25% of the patients will not be able to be receive general anesthesia for the care that they need. So we believe that these patients need to continue to be given special protection. I urge you to consider how to keep these five clinics open to serve the developmentally disabled and others who are in need. These patients deserve access to the right level of care. Please don't let them be abandoned. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much. That is a serious issue.
Hello, Mr. Chair. I'll make it quick and try not to repeat. I'm Barb Jacobson, the Chief Operating Officer at ARM, and prior to being with ARM, was in the provider field for about 25 years. I'm here to speak on two issues, the state-operated dental services and MEDO. For all the reasons that people have already said, the state-operated dental services are extremely important, and as a provider, five clinics wasn't enough, and so two certainly won't be enough. There are people who won't receive dental services, and I think there are some situations that happen that people don't think through. Oftentimes, significant behavioral issues are related to dental care or lack of dental care, pain, and those sorts of things. So for a provider who is already having, you know, problems finding dentists, this is just going to be another problem for them and another potential problem for placement for folks who aren't able to receive dental care.
And your clients use these facilities?
Many of our members have individuals who drive 2 or more hours to get to one of these clinics because they can't be serviced in their community dental clinics. Obviously, there's cost to everything, but cost of care of individuals who have extreme behaviors could be addressed with some dental services, which would be a much more minimal cost than what it may eventually escalate to. In regards to MEDO, MEDO may serve a purpose for a very small number of people, but again, from the provider's viewpoint, we feel we have providers who are able to provide many or most of the services that MEDO has provided, given the resources. The dollars that are spent on MEDO, our private sector providers could provide same or similar services, we feel, for less dollars and be just as efficient. We do have members who have crisis beds available that aren't being filled, that aren't being utilized. We feel that's partially due to just a lack of kind of overall collaboration and kind of continuity of really where are the resources and what can be done. And we think that's still not kind of evident. And I think I would also agree with a comment one of the members made. When people move from site to site or service to service, there's always a little deterioration in whatever's going on. And so to have the MEDL program and then have some traditional foster transitional foster care and then eventually go to a residential placement, we think that step in between really wouldn't be in most people's best interest. Again, basically, we think we have providers who can do those services. It's a matter of resources, not of providers or of capacity.
Well, thank you very much, and thank you for your patience in sticking around here. And we are adjourned.